центре Москвы сегодня был убит вор в законе Аслан Усаян.
Больше известен как Дед Хасан.
Криминальный авторитет вора в законе.
Аслан Усаяна расстреляли здесь, в самом центре Москвы.
На Поварской улице был убит известный криминальный авторитет.
Дед Хасан так и не вошел, туда его заносили истекающим.
It felt a bit like Back to the Future in Moscow this week, or at least back to the 90s, when mob hits and gangland shootouts were a regular part of the landscape in the Russian capital. Aslan Usayan, a leading mafia kingpin known as Died Hasan, or Grandpa Hasan, was shot dead in broad daylight while leaving a restaurant in downtown Moscow, just a couple kilometers from the Kremlin. The 75-year-old Usayan was one of the few remaining Vory v Zakonye, or thieves in law, legendary Soviet-era gangsters who sport elaborate tattoos, follow unwritten prison codes of conduct that date back to the Gulag, and who have been romanticized in Russian lore and popular songs for decades. Usayan had plenty of enemies in the underworld, and theories abound about what was the motive behind his killing, including competition for control of the heroin trade from Afghanistan and fights over construction contracts for the 2014 Winter Olympic Games in Sochi. Mob violence, which was widespread in the chaotic years following the Soviet breakup, has diminished considerably under Vladimir Putin's authoritarian rule. Is this week's brazen hit a sign that the gangland wars of the wild 90s are coming back? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague, hopefully recovered from all his New Year's debauchery, is co-host Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome back, Kirill.
Hopefully, yes.
Hopefully. You had one of those long Russian-style New Year's. And on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU and author of the must-read blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark. I usually introduce you as an expert on Russia's security services, but that shortchanges you a bit. You also know a thing or two about Russian organized crime and have done a lot of research on that, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's good to be here, and I probably know more than is good for me about criminals.
Well, since you've probably forgotten more about this topic than Kirill or I will ever know, let's begin with you, Mark. First of all, if you could walk us through who Usayan was, why he was important, and who may have wanted him dead, and why. And second, what does this tell us about the state of the Russian underworld at this time? What does this hit change? What does it indicate?
Well, I do think this actually is going to prove to be quite an important sort of change point within the Russian underworld. Usayan was, I would say, the last of the dinosaurs. He was the last of the old order gangsters. Born in 1937 in Tbilisi, he was a Yazidi Kurd from Georgia, but essentially had made his life, and certainly his criminal life, in Russia. He was a professional criminal. He was one of the Vory v Zakonye, the old-style sort of gangster elite from the prison camps. I mean, literally, it means thieves within the law, but that doesn't really make sense. So thieves within the code, we'll call them. He was that sort of classic figure. In some ways, I can't help but think of him as the Don Corleone figure. Not least because of his physique, who had built a multi-ethnic criminal network that really spanned most of the country, didn't really touch the Russian Far East, but apart from that, you know, he had contacts everywhere. He himself, in his sort of younger years, had certainly been willing to get his hands dirty and had gone to prison. But certainly for the last decade or so, he was, ironically enough, in some way, I hesitate to draw the comparison, but in some ways he was more like Putin's role within the deep state, in the sense of he was a negotiator, an arbitrator, a decider. He identified opportunities, but other people went out and did all the criminal activity. His role was to receive tribute, to receive respect, and to keep the network as a whole going. He was a very big player within the Russian underworld. He wasn't, as some sources have said, a sort of the king of the underworld. We have to bear in mind that most of the key players are actually ethnic Russians. They just get a lot less airplay, not least because the Russian Interior Ministry doesn't like talking about them as much and is much, much happier when it's talking about people from the south. Who would want to kill him? Well, I mean, I hesitate to say all kinds of people, but certainly there are three names that have been bandied about. The most obvious one is Tariel Onyani, Georgian criminal known as Taro, with whom he's had a long-running feud, and a long-running feud that has often erupted into violence and was probably also behind the assassination of another one of the sort of the old-school Vori, Yaponchik, back in 2009. Rovshan Janiev, who is an Azeri criminal, who is more of an up-and-comer, but very much wants to kind of occupy the niche that Usoyan occupied, and a former associate and now possible rival, Zakhar Kalashov, again a Georgian, known by the underworld nickname of Shakhro Jr. My money would be on Tariel Onyani, just simply because Onyani, although even though he's behind bars in prison, still runs his gang with a particularly sort of brutal hand. We don't really know, and in a way, I think it doesn't matter too much. I mean, to go on to the second part of your question, you know, what does this say about what's going on in the Russian underworld? This is part, anyway, of a generational shift. The new breed of gangster who's emerged, generally known as avtoriteti, authorities. Not for them, the tattoos, the sort of background in the prison camps and such like. These are gangster businessmen. They're in it for the money. Usually they actually have legitimate commercial interests as part of a whole portfolio of business interests that sort of run from the essentially legitimate to the kind of legitimate, shall I say, a sort of a factory that is entirely above board, except that most of its workers are traffic Tajiks who are being forced to work for almost minimal pay, and perhaps the raw materials are brought in through some loophole without paying customs dues, through to the entirely illegitimate, the heroin trafficking or whatever. So, you know, this new breed, you know, they don't wear tattoos because they don't want to flaunt their status. You know, it looks bad for your bikini line when you're on Saint-Tropez. They don't sort of cleave to the old rules whereby, you know, an oath is an oath and you never go back on your word and you never cooperate with the authorities or whatever. That's just in it for the money. So first thing is a generational shift to the avtoriteti. The second thing is, though, that, you know, we've had over a decade of relative peace within the underworld, and we'll talk about this later. But for me, that peace was already under considerable pressure. Again, you know, we can discuss these afterwards, but three main pressures was the 2008 financial crisis, which impoverished a lot of gangs. The opportunities provided by the Sochi Winter Olympics, you know, we're talking about, what, $18+ billion being invested there. A lot of gangs are fluttering around that particular honeypot. And finally, Afghan heroin. An increasing share of that flows through Russia, the so-called Northern Route. We're almost a third of it now, and it's growing. And again, that's completely sort of changing the balance of power within the underworld. So for all these reasons, it's, again, if I can mix metaphors, it's a powder keg that's waiting for a spark. So quite possibly Soyan's death will be that spark.
So you think we might be on the verge of a major mob war?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of people who, frankly, would rather avoid that. And therefore, there are going to be efforts to calm things down, which may be successful, though, if we look back, they haven't been in the past. But certainly, I think we're closer to the danger of a gang war now than we have at any point in the last decade.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a clip right now of Usoyan being questioned by police back in 2005, where a police officer asked him if he was, in fact, a vor v zakonie. Let's listen to that clip.
Yes, I am. With 50 years of experience, I can't be a depot worker, can I?
when you watch the video of that clip, the expression on Usoyan's face is simply priceless. I mean, the contempt that he held the police that were questioning him in. Kirill, one of the things that was seen as Vladimir Putin's main accomplishments was that he seemed to restore order in Russia, that he seemed to end the wild gangland violence of the so-called wild, wild East decade of the 1990s. Does the Usoyan killing indicate that this may not be the case?
I don't know. I'm not an expert in this particular field of knowledge. but I mean about the criminal structures in modern Russia. But I can speak something about, first of all, public attitude to the decades of 1990s and the previous decade of 2000s. The difference between them from the point of view of, ordinary citizen is that in 1990s you had to, if you are, you know, businessman, a small businessman, or maybe even a big businessman, you had to have a so-called krisha, safety roof, in some right. sense, yes. But this safety roof in 1990s, it was more from the, you know, some local gangs and mm-hmm. so on, some from criminal structures. And in 2000s, you have to have the same krisha, same safety roof, but from the police. Mm-hmm. And that is that indicates the very change of the nature of organized violence in modern, in post-Soviet Russia. In 1990s, this was really that was a place of various gang wars and so on. In some sense, it was a chaos because the state was unable to stop it, unable to do something with this, and so on. But in 2000s, what had happened? State pushed away this criminal structure as the main player on this criminal, zone or field. And the state, especially police and secret police, FSB, took a place of these gangs and so on as a whole, state krisha.
Yeah, we went from the era of the krisha, yes. the protection, to the gosudarstvena krisha, the state. The yes. state protection, and that's that was an important shift.
That's very important. Secondly, of course, that this wild years of 1990s finished or had been finished was one of the main points of Vladimir Putin rhetorics in the end of 2000s. Mm-hmm. That was main, the main achievement of his regime and so on. But ordinary people, they don't see any difference between being under krisha or under the safety roof of gangs or of the state, because in some sense maybe it's better to face criminal petty, especially petty criminal, than policemen in post-Soviet Russia. So that is the choice. And I think it's not just a moral choice. It's not just aesthetic choice. It's just a, political choice.
Mm-hmm. So what I hear you saying is the state basically took on the functions yeah. of the mafia, or
in some sense,
put another
yeah.
way, in the 90s, the mafia was playing the role of the state. And that's a nice segue into what question I wanted to put to you, Mark, is in the 90s, like I said, the mafia played the role of the state. They collected taxes. It was called protection. They enforced order under the so-called krisha system. Under Putin, the state, as Kirill pointed out, reasserted itself. The gos-krisha system kind of came into existence. What role did the mafia play under Putin then, if they weren't playing this kind of more all-encompassing role of kind of controlling and collecting protection from almost any enterprise as they were in the 90s? What happened to the big gangs of the 90s, the Tambovskaya gang, which was very strong in Petersburg, the Kazanskaya gang, the Solntsevo gang, which is very strong in Moscow? What role did they play under Putin? How is it different from the role they played in the 90s?
Yes, well, all those gangs are still alive and well, but they are indeed different. They have adapted. I mean, if we look at what Putin did, and as in so many ways, it has to be said, first of all, that Putin was lucky. He came to power anyway at a time in which the gang wars of the 1990s were burning themselves out. Those gang wars have been essentially struggles in the sudden anarchic chaos of the 90s to grab resources, to grab territory, and to establish hierarchies. And, as the wars end, as people realize who are the stronger gangs, who are the weaker gangs, anyway, a degree of... peace is hardly the right word, but shall I say less active war, was already emerging. So in that respect, Putin was going with the grain. But secondly, when he came to power, first, there was a real fear within organized crime that he meant what he said in terms of his tough rhetoric. I mean, for example, there was an interesting spike in illegal outflow of gangster money just before and right after the election, as everyone was worried and sort of moved their money abroad just in case. And you had, again, the tales of people, as in back in the Stalinist days, of, you know, having a suitcase already packed under the bed, just in case. In this case, it was because in case you had to just suddenly sort of get in a car and head for the airport or the border. But it soon became clear that that wasn't what Putin was about. And in fact, the word was literally sort of put out to key gangster figures, was that, you know, there will not be a massive crackdown on organized crime. What there will be, though, is a complete lack of tolerance for anything that looks like a challenge to the state, which includes the kind of overt gangsterism on the streets that have been such a problem then. So what happened is not that organized crime was defeated, destroyed, or even particularly weakened, but it was house-trained. The second part of that is, you know, again, as with all good house training, it's not just about, you know, smacking the dog. It's also about giving him a treat. So what happened was precisely that organized crime was brought into the system. You know, yes, there's been this transition from Krisha to Goskrisha, but it doesn't mean that organized crime has been squeezed out. It's actually that, you know, we have to realize that the boundaries between state and gangs is far, far more permeable and hazy than you might find elsewhere. I mean, what these groups are now, and let's face it, these aren't so much gangs in the sort of the classic old sense. Again, that was another way in which Usoyan's network was actually something of an anachronism. The modern organized crime gangs, such as Saltzeva, which you mentioned, which is a truly transnational grouping, they're really more like networks of essentially autonomous criminal entrepreneurs.
Like financial industrial groups, then, sort of, almost.
Except even more hazy. I think the point is, it's sort of today, this element and this element within the network is getting together because they're moving some heroin. Tomorrow, someone might have spotted a great opportunity raiding a company on the outskirts of Moscow, for which it needs a different set of allies. It needs someone who's got a judge in his pocket or whatever. And so that element within the network will work together. So it's constantly morphing and changing. In some ways, it's almost like a criminal club, which gives you your array of contacts and so forth. And the point is, they now work with the state more than anything else. I don't mean in terms of like an alliance. You see overheated stuff about the Kremlin runs organized crime or organized crime runs the Kremlin. Neither of those is true. But on the other hand, people have realized that the best racket is the state. And in that respect, we're back to the late Soviet days. We're back to the days when organized crime existed, but it realized that the biggest gang was the Communist Party and the corrupt officials in the Communist Party. And therefore, if you're going to do anything, you know, apart from just the pettiest of shakedowns, you know, against kiosk owners or whatever, if you really wanted to make money in the late Soviet days, you had to be working hand in glove with corrupt officials. Mm-hmm. We're back to that pattern now. Of these sort of strange and, you know, entirely sort of covert deals between gangsters who don't admit they're gangsters. You know, the days of an Usoyan who would be happy to say, of course I'm a vor, they're over. Nowadays it's, good grief, no. You know, look, I run my own charity. How can you possibly think I'm a gangster? So gangsters, politicians, and business often working hand in hand. Mm. And mainly, you know, not mainly, but sort of, they're doing two things. One is they're being involved in trafficking, everything from heroin to guns to people to whatever. Or else the other biggest moneymaker is precisely embezzlement of government funds.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not sure this model ever really went away. I mean, if you look back at the 90s, and I could speak very specifically about the case of St. Petersburg, and about the Tambovskaya Grupirovka, the Tambov group, and its leader, Vladimir Kumarin, who later changed his name to Vladimir Barsukov and who was arrested in 2009. But in the 90s, he pretty much was merged with the city government. He controlled the Petersburg Fuel Company, and he was very, very tight with the administration of former St. Petersburg governor Vladimir Yakovlev, and there were some ties with Putin as well. So you did have, at the local level at least, in the 90s, a sort of merger with state structures at that level. So is this something that just kind of dropped off and went local in the 90s and now is coming back and under the Putin reign became more of a national phenomenon? Or how did things change from the Soviet period to the 90s to now in terms of this relationship between the state and the organized criminal structures?
I think St. Petersburg was something of an exception. And in that respect, I mean, it's fascinating how often we've talked about Putin's rise also meaning the rise of the St. Petersburg clan within national politics. Well, in some cases, you know, in some ways, we've also actually therefore seen the rise of the St. Petersburg model.
Mm.
The point is, St. Petersburg was distinct. I mean, in Moscow, you had this really strong mayor's office, right. Mayor Lushkov, and his wife, and the massive commercial enterprise that was Mayor Lushkov and his wife. But also, I mean, that was a place where, in some ways, because it was Moscow and because it was so rich, you still had multiple competing key groupings. You had the Chechens, you had Saltsevera, you had the Lyubetsy still, that kind of thing. Then you had other locations like Yekaterinburg, like Vladivostok, where actually the criminals were far more powerful.
Mm.
And in a way, there the local authorities were as much as anything else just simply pawns of the gangsters. St. Petersburg hit that sweet spot of, on the one hand, you had really strong criminals who were able to particularly sort of capitalize on control of key resources, the energy industry in particular. But you also actually had a strong local authority. And therefore, you actually had this alliance of, in some ways, relative equals. You know, the St. Petersburg government had the cops and the secret police and the other levers to crack down on the gangs if they really wanted to. The gangs had the money and the guns to be powerful, and they both decided that it was actually better for them to work together. And that is, of course, the model that Putin inherited as he rose within the St. Petersburg apparatus, and to which he was inevitably exposed. Right. And I think that's what we've seen now spread across Russia.
That's an interesting point you make about the Petersburg model, because, again, I worked as a reporter in Petersburg in the 90s, and it was pretty amazing. I mean, the deputy speaker of the St. Petersburg Legislative Assembly, a man called Viktor Novosyolov, who was assassinated back in, if I'm not mistaken, 1999, he was known to be one of the bridges between the authorities and the Tambov group. There was a deputy governor in Vladimir Yakovlev's administration who was known to be a bridge. It wasn't only a collaboration, it was often the same people. Kumarin's nickname, as I'm sure you know, was Nochnoy Gubernator, the night governor. Right. So you had the governor who was the official governor, but he was the unofficial governor. Now, one thing I did want to get a reaction on, though, is that Kumarin was arrested back in 2009. And certainly with Putin's acquiescence at the very least, and I suspect with his strong support, what was going on here? Was Putin kind of cutting ties with the old gangsters that may know too much about him, or what was going on there?
I think, again, it reflects the fact that the state is the biggest gang in town. Ultimately, the state still gets to define the rules. And as we've seen within the realm of politics, you can be a friend today, but inconvenient tomorrow. I think the whole point about Kumarin, and generally what had been going on in St. Petersburg, is that, firstly, there was a sense that Kumarin had become a bit too powerful.
Uh-huh.
Secondly, a sense that it was embarrassing. Again, you know, we can talk about the St. Petersburgization of state crime links, but it's not the kind of topic that's comfortable for Putin. But also, I think it reflected wider issues in terms of the fact that Kumarin had made enemies, sufficient enemies that either Putin would have wanted him gone, or just simply Putin was no longer willing to expend the capital to keep him out of prison. In all these cases, everyone is disposable.
Mm.
All alliances, are important until they're no longer important, and then you forget about them. This is what I mean. Again, the old Vor culture had this notion of loyalty and that your word was your bond. The new criminal culture is purely, it's all about the business, and what works today may well not work tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Kirill, is there anything you want to add to this?
I fully agree with Mark about this example of St. Petersburg, but I think as an example for the whole country in 2000s. But I think the difference is that in the 1990s, mafia or criminal structures, they used state as a tool. And now state is using criminal world as a tool, and that is the main difference. It's not that, you know, state is really the main or the most horrible gang in the town, but anyway, in some sense, state now is, you know, at the place of the criminal world because it's breaching the law all the time, endlessly, step by step. And in this sense, when the legitimacy of state itself, the modern regime itself, is in question. Mm-hmm. That is a very good, you know, ground for using criminal world for in its own ends. That is the answer. I think that is the main difference, because state now in 2012 and 2013. In Russia is on the brink of being unlawful. Mm. It's very important. Criminal world is on the brink, but on the other side of the law, but really on the brink of being lawful or legal. And on the other side of this, very close to it, but on the other side of this, you know, border, is the state. And that is a very good ground for the, you know, cooperation and so on. But number one is in this cooperation is state, and number two is criminal world.
But we're seeing a merger in terms of the moral sense as much as the
moralist, but well, I not, think, yes, you know.
All right, well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion about organized crime and take a broader look at the unique culture and mores of the Vori and how organized crime and its relationship to the state has evolved and changed historically in Russia. I'd like to remind you that you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. On the Skype line with me from New York City is NYU professor and longtime Kremlin watcher Mark Galliotti, author of numerous books on Russia and author of the must-read blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us in the second half of the program will be Mirkat Shirapjanov, a correspondent for RFRL's Central Newsroom. I'd like to remind you, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
Коп, стоп, ты отказала в ласке мне. Коп, стоп, ты так любила звон монет. Ты шубки беличьи носила, кожи крокодила, все полковником стелила. Ноги на ночь мыла, мир болотной совсем забыла. И перо за это получает. Ты шубки беличьи носила, кожи крокодила, все полковником стелила.
That was Alexander Rosenbaum singing Gopstop, an underground Soviet-era song about a gang killing a snitch. Like gangsters everywhere, Russian mobsters have been romanticized throughout the ages and are the subject of endless lore. Much of it is centered around the legendary Vori v Zakone, or Thieves in Law, or as Mark likes to say, Thieves in the Code. The Vori of old did indeed live by a strict code. It included living a modest lifestyle, not displaying emotions, not holding a regular job, forsaking familial ties, and helping other Vori at all times, and refusing any cooperation with the state. Kirill, let's start with you. Why are the Vori and Vori culture, why are they so fascinating? And why are they so much a big part of Russian popular culture? What accounts for this fascination, in your opinion?
There are several reasons for this, but first of all, I have to say that from the point of view of, you know, ordinary Soviet and still Russian, you know, towner, обыватель, right, this culture is disgusting. Is just disgusting. So we have to understand this, and that is a very important mark, or you know, symbol of the world to which you are not belong. For instance, when I lived in Russia, and you know, I took a bus, and usually that loud music in Russian buses, especially in so-called microbuses, right, marshrutka. Right. And in 99%, this music will be you know, some kind of criminal songs, this so-called Russian chanson. That is the modern term for all this, you know, part of musical culture. And you can survive even with your, you know, iPod or something like this because it's very loud and it's very poisonous. In various meanings of this word, poisonous, musically poisonous. But that is, you know, just lyrical.
But there is a fascination with
this
culture.
Yes, there is a fascinating. And I try to focus on various reasons from my point of view, which are crucial for this. First of all, it's Stalin legacy, Gulag legacy, because in his great terror policy, he not just used the NKVD and other secret police bodies and the police itself and so on, he used criminal world, because criminals, they were, I don't know how it's in English, socially близки, socially close to proletarian dictatorship. Of course, real proletarian will not be socially close to criminal. That is a great lie. And that was a great light of Soviet ideology from Stalin and so on. And that was, it's very interesting, that was not the politics of Lenin era. Lenin despised, absolutely despised criminal world, and all so-called old Bolsheviks, they despised all this. That was the invention of Stalin's era, because he had to manage somehow the situation in Gulag and this, all this empire of various criminals, from real criminals to, you know, political prisoners and so on. Secondly, it's of course, it's because of population of Soviet Union, because big part of the population of the country came through their prisons and colonies and all this Gulag system. And after returning, even if they were a part of, you know, political prisoners and so on, anyway, they came through this poisonous, again, poisonous world. And they returned from these places in some sense being, you know, a little bit closer to it. And that's why they're sometimes they're response to this type of culture was more, you know, positive and warm than in other situation and so on. And my third point is that it's because of social economy, because in the situation with strict social state, socialist state economy, where just almost everything is restricted. Everyone can be or could be a criminal in some situation.
Yes.
Just trying to, you know, to buy another one bottle of vodka. And you are just on the distance of one step from your today occupation to the prison. And that's why, you know, feeling having this feeling of this closeness of this criminal world, of course you respond to this culture maybe in some another way then and so on. And another one, it's common for any Western culture, of course, this law of criminal world is part of so-called romantic culture of 19th century. That is a legacy of romanticism.
Merkat, as I understand, you spent nearly 6 years as a political prisoner in Soviet Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
And we were speaking off mic earlier today, and you were explaining to me, as we were preparing for this program, that there was something of a special relationship in the prisons in the 1970s between the Vory and the politicals like yourself, despite Stalin's best efforts in an earlier era to use the criminal world. The criminal world really wasn't interested in being used, from what you were telling me.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Kirill that it was Stalin's legacy, and in the beginning the idea was to control the situation in the camp, in Gulag, in the prisons in the Soviet Union. The whole country was a huge, big Gulag. But it changed. By 70s, I had several chances to see Vory v Zakone. Mainly you see them during a so-called etap, when you're transferred from one jail to another, or from a sanitary jail to some labor camp. What I feel and what I saw was always a respect. All the political prisons were really revered by Vory v Zakone, thieves in law. They usually were met in sometimes when, well, it's even now in Russia and elsewhere in the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, all the jails are overwhelmed by people, and there is no chance to put politically political prisoners separate in separate cells during the transfer or transit or something. And they are together with others. And usually they were respected very well. They're treated very well by other prisoners. And this is what the order comes from. And then also in as Stalin created the system, that was purely Stalin's creation, the Voriv Zakoni and this stuff. Even you have to remember that during Soviet times, all the prisons were factories, huge factories, producing you just imaginable and unimaginable things, products, including tractors. You know, some machines used in agriculture and stuff. Many of them were exported to Mongolia, to elsewhere. You know, to other socialist countries, and very often. The production plan was controlled not by prison officials, but by the criminal world. And Voriv Zakoni were asked by the prison's officials to help them to fulfill the month plan by time, you know, and that was the order.
Wouldn't that go against the Voris code where they are not supposed to cooperate with the authorities?
Yeah, but you have to remember that things changed by that time. Things were changing. Huge Voriv Zakoni. Well, I know that by the collapse of the Soviet Union, there are probably less than 2,000 real Voriv Zakoni, as I tried to just study this what happened there. Things were changing from 30s till today. Today, Voriv Zakoni are sitting in Cyprus and ruling their mafia through Skype. They even don't go to Sotka anymore. Today we have a lot of Voriv Zakoni who are apelsini. They are not those who spend amount.
Yeah, could you explain that? Because that's a very interesting. Yeah. But the apelsini is a very interesting.
Yeah, the
point.
Oranges, so-called oranges. To be a Voriv Zakoni, you have to spend the certain amount of time in jail to show yourself as a real leader, organizer, to be not a coward, to stand anything, to be a brave guy who denies everything. This is another thing why people adore this culture.
And you go through intensive training, initiation, and so
and
on.
And stuff like that. It's not mainly about training. It's about your own character. And today, in 90s, they became...
Samurai code.
Yeah, yeah.
Samurai code, yes.
Yeah. Today, especially in 90s, it became possible to buy this title for several million of dollars.
Wow.
And those Voriv Zakoni of old generation, they call them apelsini or oranges.
Oranges, right.
And they don't... And this is a huge standoff between them. And they don't agree with them. They don't consider them. You know, there were some other exclusions. There was a prominent Voriv Zakoni, Vasya Brilliant, who was the first one who took arms in his hand and went to the World War II as a legend. And that was probably the first huge break of the thief's code. But he came back and he continued to be revered by Voriv Zakoni. So there were exclusions, things were changing, and by the time when the Soviet Union collapsed, Voriv Zakoni were much more different than those who were in the 30s. And we talk about Voriv Zakoni today, they're much more different than those who are represented by Det Hassan, who was killed this week.
Yeah, no, Mark Merkai referred to something here that I wanted you to expound on a little bit, is that the Stalin period did kind of change the Vorty culture to a degree, and the Vorty culture goes back to the Russian Empire. But that in one of the key points was World War II. And there was disagreement, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, there was disagreement within the criminal world whether or not to break the Voriv code and collaborate with the state in this great patriotic war effort. And there was a split among the Vori. And there was the so-called Suchaya Vaina, or the in the vernacular, the bitch war. And the ones that didn't collaborate remained kind of the old Vori, and those that did became the kind of forebearers of the what we now call the avtoriteti or the authorities. Is that a correct assessment of that, Mark?
Yes, the division, after all, within the underworld had started before World War II. As has been mentioned, that in fact, in order to manage this massive labor camp population as cheaply and as efficiently as possible. The Stalinist state sought to co-opt criminals, criminals to keep the politicals in line. And those who are willing, because after all, you get all kinds of perks by working for the state, those who are willing to become trustees within the prison camp system became known as Suki bitches within the sort of the Vor community. But before World War II, they were very much a minority. And to a large extent, they just simply victimized the political prisoners who made up the majority of the people. They left the Vori alone because they knew that that was dangerous to mess with them. Then along comes the Great Patriotic War. You have people within the Vorovskoy Mir, the thieves' world, who, you know, out of patriotism are willing to join up from the camps. You have others who are just forced into it, people being recruited from the camps and being put into penal battalions. And they may not have felt that they were breaking the code of the Vori, but they were by taking up arms. And when the war was over and they were sent back into the prison camps, they often found themselves being victimized and excluded. But also you had a massive influx of people who up to this point, you know, had been complete outsiders, prisoners of war. As far as Stalin was concerned, no Soviet soldier should ever have allowed himself to fall into the hands of the enemy. And therefore, if he was in a prison camp, you know, he was by definition a traitor to the motherland. So you had this sort of ghastly spectacle of thousands upon thousands of Soviet prisoners being freed from Nazi prison camps, loaded under guard onto trains, and trundled off to Soviet labor camps instead. So here you have a collection of battle-hardened individuals. All right, interesting. Terrible, but interesting. You have sort of these people who, you know, they've come from a war, they've been trained to fight, and fight as a unit rather than just as tough individuals, who suddenly find themselves forced to basically join one side or the other within the criminal sort of hierarchies. They're not Vori, so of course they naturally have to side with the bitches, with the collaborators. So all of a sudden you have far, far more of the anti-Vor faction within the underworld. And what happens is a war. Through the late 40s and the early 50s, the whole Gulag system is ripped by struggles between the traditionalists and the collaborators. Clearly the authorities want to support the latter, and they can do so in all kinds of ways, including just simply giving them key jobs, like making someone a barber means he has access to a razor. In other words, he has a weapon in camp. Making someone a cook means he has access to a knife. You know, all these little ways in which actually you can make sure that your people win. And so you have this war that rips through the Gulag system, which also in part is one of the reasons for the ending of the Gulag labor camps in its Stalinist incarnation, because it was no longer cost effective because of the fact that you're having to deal with uprisings and wars all the time. And essentially they won, the collaborators won. And when they did that, they didn't just ditch the notion of the Voiva Zakonia, they just rewrote the code. Mm-hmm. They just said, oh, you know, we like all these bits of it, but on the other hand, it's okay to collaborate with the authorities if it's in your interests, mm-hmm. not because you believe in the, you know, proletarian mission of the Communist Party, but because today you will benefit. Mm. So as long as you are the beneficiary, that's okay. So they more or less, you know,
if your clan benefits, Obchak.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's what happened exactly. You have an underworld that is shaped by the Stalinist experience, and by the time the gulags are opened and therefore all the, and let's face it, they let the criminals out before the politicals, you know, your underworld has therefore been rewritten to more or less say, hey, it's okay to deal with corrupt officials.
So these were the people that made the Soviet black market go, and by extension who made the Soviet economy function essentially, right?
Yeah, and I mean, although many of the, you know, tattooed hard men might not have been sort of the people who became the black market entrepreneurs of the late Soviet era. They were the people who protected and preyed on the entrepreneurs, but also they were the key link people between the black market and the corrupt party officials. There was a kind of an unholy trinity. Corrupt officials, gangsters, and black marketeers. And together they, as you said, kept the system working in their own benefit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one more thing I wanted to add, just if I may, just shortly. By the 90s, the most disciplined and structured system there, remaining there in the former Soviet Union, was the criminal world, where at least something worked. Mm-hmm. Other things were falling apart. And that's why Yaponchuk was released. That's why he was included in Roland Bykov's group to go to the United States, and there are some speculations that Yosef Kobzon was involved in that. They're just things which we know, but there are many things we don't know when officials had to use this structured system to keep things going.
And as you were telling me off mic earlier today, it was almost like the Vor code became the code of post-Soviet Russia for the decade of the 90s in a lot of
in some sense, yes, of course.
I want to play another clip of this of some more of this music that romanticizes this world. Let's listen to another clip. That was the song Murka, performed by Arkady Severny, a song about a female gangster who violates the thieves' code by dancing with somebody outside the life. As we've been alluding to throughout this program, despite their immortalization in pop culture, the true Vori are actually a dying breed. I mean, Usayan was really one of just a handful that were alive before he was assassinated this week. And Mark, you alluded to this a little bit earlier on, but that how today's gangsters are different from the Vori of old. Can you elaborate about that a little bit more? How the whole thing is changing now?
Yeah, I mean, I think although there are people who still call themselves Vori, as we've heard nowadays, you can buy that title. It means far, far less. It's basically sort of little more than a vanity plate on your Mercedes. The notion of a monastic gangster elite who don't benefit from their profits so much. Again, Mirkat mentioned the Obstjak. This was a sort of communal fund that the gang would have, not least to look after the dependents of people who went into prison and such like. The idea that you would pay tax to a collective, it's a very socialist model of criminality, one might suggest.
Nowadays, very feudal, by the way.
Feudal, well.
But in nowadays, it's essentially about self-enrichment. It's about the sort of the glitz, and that's, you know, obviously also a lot of the elements that come up within this, you know, Russian chanson, which in its own way isn't, you know, take away the actual sort of structure, it's not that different from gangster rap or Mexican narco corridas, and it very much exalts the idea that the criminal is on the one hand the individual with no constraints, the guy who you know, takes no nonsense from anyone else, does whatever he wants, gets the girls, gets the money and everything and so forth. You know, it's a very primal message. But there's a lot of truth in that. I think the modern Russian underworld is simply about making money. And that's why they don't care whether it's crime, whether it's legitimate business, it's whatever is just simply the shortest route from A to B. And in that respect, what we're now seeing is in some ways the normalization of Russian organized crime. It's different simply because the environment is different, because actually there are so more opportunities compared with, for example, most Western countries to be within the state apparatus or within legitimate business and also be a major organized crime figure. But essentially, in terms of the idea that it's all about personal entrepreneurship, you band together in groups simply insofar as it's useful. Your loyalties, you know, you may have personal relationships to people, but you have no kind of wider loyalty to a group or a culture or a code or whatever. In that respect, it's actually surprisingly normal. You know, if we're talking about the new normal, this is the underworld's new normal, and it's strikingly similar to everyone else's.
So it's, in a sense, it's moved from a more communal system to a more individualistic entrepreneurial system. And in that way, I guess the criminal world has mirrored some of the changes that have happened in the country writ large. Right? Kirill, I see you writing things down. Is there something you want to add here?
Yes, it's not Japanese versus Hokko and so on. I'm not very nostalgic about the destruction and decline of the old school, gangster world in Soviet Union. I'm not very happy with, introducing a new Brave New World of Oranges and so on. For me, it's the same. Historically, it's different, but for ordinary people, it's almost the same. But the most interesting thing about all these things, from my point of view, I'm not I'm not an expert in this in the structure of criminal worlds and so on, of criminal world in Russia and so on, is this pop culture based on mafia or criminal tales, songs and so on. The main difference between this culture, this type of culture, and in the Soviet times, in Brezhnev times, and today, is that in 1970s and even in the beginning of 1980s, that was a kind of subculture. It was just one subculture, one of the numerous of them. Yeah. And now, if you switch on Russian TV, or just watch, you know, inauguration of Vladimir Putin.
If you listen to Vladimir Putin speak,
yes,
by the way.
Yes, and that is the mainstream. Maybe not the only one of two the mainstreams in the modern Russian culture, but that is the truth, that it's not a subculture anymore. And that is very dangerous for me. And that is the main difference between rap culture in the United States or this Mexican, narco songs and narco corrida, drug corrida, mm-hmm. Something like this in Mexico. Because for instance, this criminal songs, Russian chanson, Russian chanson, it's not chanson, of course, but chanson, mm-hmm. It's a French pop songs. But I don't know why French is, sounds very romantic in the Russian language.
Not only.
Yes. So anyway, this Russian chanson now, it tries to disguise or to show itself like a grassroots traditional anti-modernist part or real Russian culture. It's not a real Russian culture. Real Russian culture is, Russian literature. Real Russian culture is Russian folk songs, which are not criminals, which are not about criminals, which are about peasants or, imshiki and so on. It's not about criminals. So all the traditional and high and folk Russian culture is not about all these things. And now this chanson culture or criminal culture or culture of former underworld in Russia tries to be, to expose itself like an only one source of a great Russian soul tradition, soul, not in music sense, but soul, right. Duchovnosti, right. Yes, tradition and so on. And that is very disgusting. That is very disgusting because when we can stand all this when it was, just a subculture. You can just, never touch it. You could, just close your eyes or close your, ears and don't never listen to it. But now it's impossible. It's impossible. Just impossible.
That's one of the most popular radio stations in Russia, Radio Chanson.
Yeah.
All the songs are 24/7. And I just wanted to say that the majority of Lariv Zakoni were people from Georgia, ethnic Georgians, not only ethnic Georgians, but people mainly from Georgia, people from Siberia, at least those I met. I think that today's leadership of Georgia realizes that, and this is a big danger even in Georgia, not only in Russia. We know that Saakashvili introduced a law according to which anyone who is proven to be a vor v zakoni, not proven to do something wrong, but to have a title, to be coronated, is supposed to go to jail for several years. So it's a big problem, not only in Russia. And as I always say, the Soviet Union collapsed. But this system of Lariv Zakoni is still there. The Soviet Union, in their minds, is still there. Whatever they call them, whatever you call them, Apelsini, Lariv Zakoni, whatever you call them, but the system is still there. We know that there's Jora Tashkentsky, there are Rizhi Almas in Almaty, who was killed in Barcelona. There are Kazakhs, there are Russians, there are Georgians, there are Armenians, Kurdish Yazidis, whatever. But the system is still there, and it's a very dangerous thing, not only in Russia, but elsewhere in the former Soviet Union.
Mirka, before we wrap up, there's actually one thing I wanted to get you to talk about. Again, it's something we were talking about a bit off mic today, is the tattoos, the slang. There's a whole, I actually found on the internet a whole list of what every tattoo means.
That was because the prison system, when a person comes to prison, first he goes to quarantine. How do you pronounce it in English? He is supposed to go through the shower and special procedures. And as soon as he comes to jail, everybody's supposed to see who he is. It's not necessary to ask him about what rank he is occupying in this hierarchy. It's not the case anymore today. But old days, the stars on their shoulders had a meaning that he is a vor of zakonye. The special signs on their knees, meaning that he is a brave guy who never stand on his student.
Never
his
kneel
knees.
Before anyone.
Yeah. And they're a lot. They're like, you know.
An upside down spider means you're an active criminal. A Madonna in child means that you were a criminal from childhood.
It's in childhood, yeah. And then there's special abbreviations like, you know. Slon, no, other things, and about the spider. Spider in the cell, in the prison cell, is called a master of the cell. He's always there. He's the boss. Uh-huh. So the guy who has a spider, he doesn't go out of the cell. He always in cell. He always is jailed, and he's a professional criminal. So that's there. But again, this culture is withering, and today, you know. Many vor of zakonye today speak English, or you know, live in Barcelona or somewhere else, and you know.
Interesting. Do they translate the fascinating criminal slang into English? Because a lot of it is untranslatable.
My favorite tattoo, criminal tattoo in Russia, is on the legs. Они устали. They are tired.
To run away from police.
Yes.
To run away from police. Yes. And also, there is a famous tattoo. On the skull, опять дома. When a person is in jail and he is shaved, the head is always shaved in a Russian jail. So home again. Home again.
And the tattoo of the cathedral means you've served three terms. Is that?
Yeah, it depends on how many cupolas are on the cathedral. Every cupola is a term or a criminal case.
Uh huh.
Sometimes when it's like too much years, like 17, it's not possible. They just count the cases. Sometimes it's the years. It depends.
Well, the final thing I want to put to all of you before we wrap up, and this has been a quite a fascinating discussion, is this vodification of popular culture, is it something that's going to fade away? Or do you think this is almost a semi-permanent feature now?
I think it's going to be permanent. That's my opinion, unfortunately. It's in our genes, as Kirill said, that every second family in the former Soviet Union went through it. My own grandfather, I just was 41 when I first saw his face, was a boss in a collective farm. He was jailed for not being able to save harvest when it was snowing in August. He went to penalty battalion from Gulag, and he disappeared there. He died in Ukraine. My other relative, my uncle, was a prisoner of war during World War II. He returned home in 1956 after Stalin's death and immediately was sent to Sakhalin, lost his eyes and hand. His wife was waiting for him all those years, and they had six children. And I was very shocked in 1989 when he was buried that six KGB people came to see if he was really dead, and it was him who was buried. And this is still there. Unfortunately, this system has too deep roots there. It goes together with Soviet past, and Soviet past, unfortunately, has new forms of today's present. It is present today in new forms. It's the same way how the criminal world changed but still exists. Putin's Russia or Nazarbayev's Kazakhstan, it's a model of Soviet system with some kind of modifications. Something has changed, but the system is still there. And if Soviet Union was a prison of maximum security, Today, former Soviet republics are prisons with minimum security, mm-hmm. but still prisons. That's why Voriv Zakony culture is going to be there.
Mm-hmm. Kirill?
No, I'm not so pessimist as Mirkhat.
You're usually a pessimist.
Yes, but now everything is changing. I think that it's up to the ability of new political and social classes in Russia to invent more powerful political and social and pop culture. Pop culture is crucial in this question. Yeah. It's not about the highbrow culture. It's about a new type of pop culture. If they invent, this type of pop culture without any connections to the criminal world, to the intonation, the very intonation, criminal intonation of criminal pop songs or criminal speech and so on, I think that this culture will disappear.
It will take time, though.
Yes, I think one, two generations. But, of course, it will not happen. It couldn't happen now. But anyway, it's a very interesting and intriguing task to do this. And I think that healthy social groups in Russian population, they have to just to begin to undertake this, because that is more important than to fight against so-called Kravavy regime, bloody regime now, because that is the task for several decades. That is the task for two or three generations, maybe, because the legacy is so heavy. The deep. Legacy is very deep, and a lot of people just have to work together to do this.
And that's why the song Alexandrovsky Central is the most popular in Russian karaoke clubs.
Mark, last word to you.
Yeah, I think I would be more on the optimistic Kirill side of things. I mean, I'm half Italian, but I don't feel that it's encoded within my DNA to respect men of honour. And in fact, nor do many Italians. I mean, it takes things, things change. But I exactly agree, we're talking about something that is going to be generational. At the moment, yes, gangster culture has moved into the mainstream. And I say this shamefacedly as someone who half his iPod is probably Ruski Chanson. But you see, for example, people who were not sort of gulag veterans with gangster tattoos, not because of the old meanings, but just because they think they look cool. You have not just Putin, but a lot of people using mat, sort of gangster language as part of the cultural mainstream. That's going to take time to sort of deal with and normalize. You have the fact that organized crime in some ways has merged with a sense of nationalism. I always think it's sort of very compelling that there were these sort of two sort of quite key films, Brat and Brat 2, Brother and Brother 2. And in the sort of slightly higher gloss sequel, the Russian gangster goes to America just to show those American thugs how much tougher a Russian thug can be. And in that respect, there is almost this perverse pride in actually having the smartest cyber criminals, the toughest gangsters, and so forth. Again, that will have to be outgrown. And I think there's a really fundamental point that there is still, I think, a sense that capitalism equals enrichment, without realizing, in fact, a mature working capitalism is as much as anything else about trust and sort of cooperative relationships within society. There is still that sense that basically, that's what it's all about, that it's all about making money. Again, this is going to have to change. I mean, I'm not saying for every Russian or whatever, but I'm just simply saying it's still a dangerously sort of pervasive element. So in this respect, it's about creating new models. It's about, perhaps most importantly, having a state that does not see itself in criminal terms. I mean, one of the reasons why criminals have legitimacy is, as mentioned before, that there is this massive gap between rulers and ruled, a massive credibility gap, as people think that, well, the state is no better than gangsters. So it really is a question of whether you have criminals in uniform or criminals in shiny suits. That is a very corrosive factor when you're trying to actually deal with the criminalization of culture. All of these things, though, ultimately are manageable. I wouldn't say at the moment, I wouldn't say in the next 5 years, or even necessarily in the next 10 years. But if we look at, for example, the slow emergence of Russia, of Italy, rather, sorry, from under the shadow of the mafia and the sort of the mafia mentality, a slow 2 steps forward, 1.5 steps back, unwillingness from the Italians to accept that kind of behavior on the part of their government as well as their criminals, you know, this is actually a sign for optimism, even if it's of a very long-term geological time optimism.
And unfortunately, that's all we have time for today, although I could continue discussing this topic with you gentlemen for hours. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague has been Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service and Mirkat Sharapzhanov, a correspondent for RFERL's Central Newsroom. And on the Skype line from New York City has been NYU professor and longtime Kremlin watcher Mark Galliotti, author of the must-read blog In Moscow's Shadows. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant producer Tanya Kancheva and my indispensable colleague Pavel Buturin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. Join us again next week when we'll give Mark a breather, and Kirill and I will be joined by Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.